This is Only a Game. I'm Howard Bryant. On Wednesday in Vieira, Florida, the U.S. will face Japan in the opening game of the Women's Baseball World Cup. Japan is the five-time defending champion, and if you're thinking that doesn't quite sound right, it's probably because earlier this week, the U.S. beat Japan in the Women's Softball World Championship. The U.S. has won that event 11 out of the 16 times it's been played. Baseball and softball both originated in the U.S., so how did the U.S. women get to be so much more competitive in one than they are in the other? Only a Game's Karen Given has the story.
Kat Williams loves baseball, not softball, baseball.
I guess maybe one way to explain it is by talking about when I first saw the movie A League of Their Own, if that's okay.
Sure.
I'm going back a little bit, but
it
is relevant.
Baseball has always been important to Kat. She grew up poor. She had a learning disability that wasn't diagnosed until well into adulthood. She says school was tough.
But when I was on a baseball field, I was good. And so there was only one place I was comfortable, and that was shortstop.
Kat says baseball saved her.
Literally, without it, I wouldn't be here. I needed that place where I was okay.
When she was in third grade, Kat remembers her teacher asking her classmates what they wanted to be when they grew up.
People were saying, oh, you know, I want to be a fireman, I want to be a nurse or a doctor or whatever. And so, you know, she said to me, well, what about you? What would you? And I said, I want to play shortstop for the Cincinnati Reds. Well, of course, the entire class burst into laughter, including the teacher. And I was mortified.
Kat wasn't embarrassed for herself. She was embarrassed for her teacher and classmates. After all, she was a really good shortstop, and the Reds were, in her estimation, the best team. Why wouldn't she play for them? Over the following years and decades, Kat found out why. Growing up before Title IX, there just weren't opportunities for her to play baseball.
You all have to get fitted for your uniform. And this is what they're going to look like.
Pretty darn nifty, if you ask me. How about that, Billy?
You can't slide in that.
I like it. It's
hey, that's a dress.
So fast forward to 1992, and Kat is sitting in a movie theater watching Gina Davis and Rosie O'Donnell and Madonna play baseball for money. The movie was set in the year 1943.
I was stunned. I was like, is this real? What? What is this? And so I watched it, and I laughed, and I cried, and at the end of it, Madonna starts to sing This Used to Be My Playground, and I just, it is still a very emotional memory for me. And I sat there in that theater, and I thought, oh my God.
Kat thought the movie couldn't possibly be based on real life. There had never been a women's professional baseball league, right? But as Madonna sang and the credits rolled, footage of actors was replaced by real players from the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League, then in their 60s and 70s, playing a reunion game at Doubleday Field in Cooperstown.
Madonna kept singing and the credits kept rolling and I kept sitting there and then more credits kept rolling and I kept sitting there and I couldn't get up. I could not leave because I knew if I left, then it wasn't going to be real. Finally, the lights came up and the guys came in to pick up the garbage off the floor. And I looked around and there were about 20 women sitting in the theater and none of us could move. None of us could leave. And I was angry. I was sad. I was blindsided. Nobody told me that history. Nobody told me I wasn't the only one.
Since that day when she sat in stunned silence while Madonna sang and sang and sang, Kat Williams has studied the history of women in sports. She became a history professor at Marshall University in West Virginia. And Kat has gotten to meet many of the women who actually played in the All-American League, women like Shirley Berkovich.
My dad used to take me down to the ball game and, you know, watch the first baseman, see how he plays.
And Maybelle Blair.
I think my mother's breast was half baseballs. I'm not for sure.
Maybelle is 91, Shirley's 85, and they're the perfect mismatched pair. Shirley grew up in a suburb outside Pittsburgh. She's quiet and shy, but sweet. She gets tears in her eyes when she talks about what the game means to her. Maybelle is loud and opinionated. She wears oversized sunglasses and walks with a cane made from a Louisville slugger. But the women tell similar stories.
when all the boys in the neighborhood would get out and have batting practice and they need somebody to chase the balls, and I got to play. I thought I was having a wonderful time. Come to think of it, I was.
I remember the neighbors telling my mom, why don't you let your daughter play with the boys all the time? And she said, well, there's no girls' teams.
My brother used to have a little uniform that my mother bought him. And when he would leave the house, I would priss around the house in that uniform, and she'd be looking out the window because he would have a fit if he ever caught me in that uniform. So she'd be like, hey, Mel, here he comes.
Did you ever think you'd have your very own uniform?
Never, 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 but I did.
There was an article in the newspaper. I didn't see it, but my brother did. And he says, why don't you go try out? I thought, oh my God, I'd be too scared to go down there and try out.
Well, I was out playing softball, and this guy came up to me, and he says, hey, I want you to go play professional baseball. I said, well, you know, there isn't any I know of, you know. He says, oh, yes, there is.
My brother took the day off of work, and he says, I'll go with you. He says, well, just sit in the stands. And I think he knew that once he got me down there sitting in the stands, there was no way I was not going to go down there and try out.
My mother kept shaking her head. No, my daughter's not leaving this house, come hell or high water. She's not leaving. Well, finally, after 30 or 40 minutes longer, he says, well, Mrs. Blair, you don't understand. We're going to pay her $65 a week. My mother looked over at my father and says, go crank up the old Model T. I'm packing her suitcase and she's out of here.
I got $55 a week. That was more than my dad was making. He worked in the steel mills. It wasn't the money. I was just so happy just to have the opportunity to play baseball. Whew.
Oh, my God, yes. I got in that little dress, my little uniform. And then what I really enjoyed was when I got on my spikes and I started to walk towards the field. It goes click, click, click. And I walked out and I saw that field and I says, oh my God, I am going to get to play baseball.
I thought that was going to be my career. 16 years old, I planned for playing forever.
But Shirley only played three seasons, Maybelle just one. Shirley says by 1950, it was clear that the end of the league was near.
Teams were being sold, attendance was down. You know, why would you want to come and sit in a hard stand when you could sit on your couch and watch TV?
Baseball for women came to a halt. You know, we're all supposed to go home and put on our little aprons and have babies and stay home and take care of the house.
Women didn't walk away from baseball. Baseball walked away from women.
Cat Williams says after the league closed down in 1954, women kept playing whenever and wherever they could. But in the decades following the All-American League, whenever and wherever was usually limited to recreational leagues, and those leagues played softball, not baseball. Softball began not as a sport for women and out-of-shape rec league players, but as a sport men could play indoors when it was too cold to play baseball outside. But baseball has always carried a subtext that has never existed for softball.
Historically speaking, baseball is, in this country, is very much about masculinity. And in the 20th century, the early 20th century particularly, it was very much about ways to create, quote, the real man.
And then in 1972, something happened that would push even more women away from baseball and towards softball.
The real divide, I think, comes about as a result of Title IX.
Yes, Title IX, the landmark federal regulation that requires, among other things, equal opportunity for men and women in education and sports.
I am a huge proponent of Title IX. In fact, I believe that Title IX is perhaps the biggest, most important piece of legislation for women since the 19th Amendment was ratified in 1920, finally giving women the right to vote. Having said all that, Title IX is one of the main reasons that we have a split between baseball and softball.
So what happened?
There's this idea that there had to be, quote, equivalency sports.
When athletic administrators interpreted the law, they didn't see anything that required them to offer the same sports for men and women, which is where the idea of equivalency sports came from.
What happened was, okay, well, we have baseball, so what we'll do is we'll make softball for girls, and softball becomes, quote, the girls' sport.
Okay, I know what you're thinking. There are plenty of girls who play baseball, right? I mean, who could forget 2014 and the Little League World Series?
All right, by now you've probably heard about Monet Davis, the pitcher from Philadelphia. But that story is quickly being updated. At first it was that she was a girl. Now it's that she's just a fantastic Little League pitcher.
And I watched that Little League World Series with great interest and cheered every pitch.
On the corner, fastball called strike one. Mom Lakeisha there, gonna be blown away by what her daughter is doing.
But I was astounded when a couple of the announcers didn't quite know what to say, and one of them looked at the other one and said, "Do girls play baseball? Do girls even play baseball?" And, you know, so that I didn't put my head through the television, I had to leave the room. But you know, the people who are supposed to know don't even know that she stands on a lot of women's shoulders.
Monet Davis is 17 years old now, and she remembers the exact moment when she realized that her presence at the Little League World Series was a very big deal.
We were in the rec room playing ping pong, and all of a sudden, I just, like, hear my name, and it's, like, next up on sports signs, like, Monet Davis. And I was like, what? Like, that's crazy.
At just 5'4", 105 pounds, 13-year-old Monet Davis relies less on strength and more on pristine mechanics to deliver.
So we watched it, and I was like, that's so cool. And then all of a sudden, like, my phone just was, like, buzzing, and it, like, would freeze, and, like, I barely got, like, text messages through. I couldn't really call people off my phone.
You were trending number one on Twitter.
Yeah, I heard that before.
Was there a high point for you, a thing that you just were like, I can't believe this is my life?
Either when I won an ESPY and then when I got to meet Barack and Michelle Obama.
Well, yeah, that would be crazy. What did they say to you?
They were just like, keep going, don't stop.
But despite that advice from the former president and first lady, Monet Davis, the best female Little League pitcher anyone had ever seen, quit her high school baseball team.
Freshman year, I wasn't pitching as much as what I wanted to do. And I would always ask the coach, and he wouldn't really give me like a good answer behind it. So then I was just like, you know what, like, if I'm just going to be sitting here not really doing anything, I might as well just try softball out.
Yeah, so you figured playing softball was better than sitting on the bench.
Yeah.
Monet is happy with her decision. She says her softball teammates were great. There's only one thing she didn't enjoy about making the switch.
Softball, they do a lot of cheering. So that was, like, kind of new to me, and I was like, can we not do that, like, singing?
It's been 75 years since the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League was founded, giving over 600 women the opportunity to play baseball and get paid for it. In the more than six decades since the league folded, generations of girls in this country have been pushed into playing softball instead of baseball.
That really upsets these old bones, I'll tell you. I need WD-40 when I think about that, you know.
Which is why Maybelle Blair, age 91, and Shirley Berkovich, age 85, are involved in an effort to build a center for women's baseball in Rockford, Illinois, where the Rockford Peaches played. They travel the country advocating for girls who want to play baseball.
There's nothing like baseball. Nothing.
And it would be so wonderful to have a league of their own and give these girls a chance. This is my goal before I get under the grass. As long as I'm this side of the grass, I'm going to be pushing it.
Only a Game's Karen Given brought us that story. 30 years ago, Allison McGee joined the YWCA in Minneapolis. It was the first and only gym she ever joined.
The Uptown Y, despite remodeling, policy changes, additions and subtractions of machines and classes, aerobics to Zumba to spin to body flow to vinyasa has remained a constant in my life.
That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
Hey, this is Stretch Armstrong.
And this is Bobbito Garcia, the hosts of What's Good.
We're back with a brand new season.
We've got Erykah Badu, Lenny Kravitz, Black Thought, and more.
You'll hear B-side stories from A-list guests. Subscribe now.
I'm Howard Bryant. It's time for three stories you should know. This week we're going to talk about two really good baseball teams and at least two really good basketball players. My guests are Michael Lee of Yahoo Sports, known as Mr. Michael Lee on Twitter. Welcome back, Mr. Michael Lee.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And making her three stories you should know debut, Ann Killian from the San Francisco Chronicle, known as Ann Killian everywhere. Hi, Ann Killian.
Hi, Howard.
All right, I'm going to bat leadoff. The Boston Red Sox are not just good. They're scary good. They're ridiculously off the charts good. The Red Sox are close to the two winningest regular season teams in history since 1906, the legendary 114-win 1998 Yankees, and the dearly departed 116-win but didn't even make the World Series 2001 Mariners. Sorry, Seattle. So here's my question, one I find myself asking in the universe. What's it all mean? Mookie Betts and J.D. Martinez could go 1-2 in the AL MVP race. The Red Sox frontline rotation of Chris Sale, Rick Porcello, and David Price, they're excellent. But there are so many bad teams out there. I mean, really bad teams. So on the one hand, a team playing 700 ball demands everyone's attention, but on the other, the Orioles are terrible, the Blue Jays are terrible, and the Red Sox are 26-6 against them combined. So I ask you, Mr. Michael Lee, must we wait until November to finally figure out what these Red Sox are? Or are they what they're doing right now impressive enough?
Well, it don't mean a thing if you don't win that ring. You know, that's sort of how I look at it. And you left out one of those really bad teams, the Kansas City Royals, which is my hometown team. So they really stink, too. So I like to add them to the mix of one of those really bad teams. But I think that we've seen from the 73-win Golden State Warriors, we've seen from the 18-0 Patriots, unless you capture that championship, you're long forgotten. Like you mentioned the Seattle Mariners. I never mention them when I'm talking about great baseball teams.
Do you still mention the Patriots, though? I mean, they lost to the Giants, but when you think of the greatest teams of all time, because they lost that last game, don't think about
them. They can't be in the conversation. We give LeBron extra credit for beating a 73-win team, but he's the champion. You got to finish the job. And if you don't, you're going to live in infamy as opposed to being considered great.
And somebody who covered that 73-win team, Ann Killian?
Well, I totally agree. I mean, let's look at Boston's payroll, which is the highest in major leagues. They're supposed to be beating up on the terrible teams, as you call them. And so while this is fun, it's impressive, they're having a great summer. It's all about October, and that's the only thing people will remember. And if they fail, as they have at certain times in the past, as a lot of big payroll teams have in the past, they will not only be not remembered as a great team, but they'll be looked at askance as a team that couldn't come through when it really counted. And that I did cover that Warriors team. And not only do fans and that public think of them as the team that didn't win a ring, they feel it. It's what drove them to the next two rings.
As an aside, there have been 14 teams in Major League Baseball that have played 700 ball over a season of at least 125 games. And only five of them won the World Series. Something to think about. And Killian, tell us something else we need to know.
Well, I know you guys aren't going to want to hear this. Don't tell anyone, especially you East Coasters, but the Oakland Athletics are the best story in baseball, maybe in all of sports right now. The team with one of the lowest payrolls in the game, kind of the opposite of the Red Sox, and a relatively anonymous collection of talent, is hot on the heels of the reigning World Series champion Astros. Unfortunately for the Athletics, no one is really paying attention. Their GM, Billy Beane, has unloaded any and all potentially marquee or marketable talent. The team has failed to come up with any plan for a new ballpark, and the fan base basically has no trust anymore. They are near the bottom in attendance, and it's so bad that last week, 25-year-old third baseman Matt Chapman appealed to fans to come out to the games, promising that they are really fun to watch. So if a team plays great baseball in a forest, but no one is there to see it, are they relevant? And should communities be denigrated and made fun of like Oakland has been for not supporting a team? Or is it really up to the team to earn that support and build that trust? What do you guys think?
Yeah, that's a good question. Michael?
Yeah, I feel like Oakland is just paying for past sins. And I think it's hard for the fans to get behind this team because they haven't been told that these players are going to be there for a long time. You know,
they've been told exactly the opposite.
Yeah, like this guy gets good, well, it's time to trade him, you know, and that sort of burns you. And it's hard to really latch on. It's difficult to blame fans for not supporting a team that doesn't seem to support them. And I don't know if the fans can get behind a player or a certain group of players because they know their heart's going to be broken the minute that guy leaves.
Well, especially if the last several years you could go back and look at the World Series, and virtually every World Series team somewhere has an Oakland A on it.
The fans do have people to root for. They're just wearing different uniforms.
Well, also, let's not forget the Oakland Coliseum or whatever it's called now. That is one of the worst ballparks.
That's what it's called now.
That's what it's called now?
Whatever it's called now.
See? Yeah. it had like five different names, but whatever. That's a dump, man.
You know what? I actually like this. I love this story, and here's why. Chris Davis looks like he's going to hit 40 home runs for the third straight season. And let's remember that Bob Melvin, the manager, he was the Yankees' first choice for the job that Aaron Boone got.
Right.
And the A's did not grant permission. They didn't allow him to go. And attendance, well, we've been dealing with this for 25 years. But here's the thing, Annie, as we always talk about anyway. Ownership has been trying for the last 25 years to leave town. So how do you get that fan base to get behind you when you're trying to bolt, you're trying to go to Fremont, you're trying to go to San Jose, you're trying to go to Portland or Vancouver or anywhere else you go? Last question for you, Ann Killian. Does this terrific story last throughout September?
I think it does. They kind of are embracing their awful Coliseum and their lack of fans. They're getting a little chip on their shoulder. So I feel like right now they're playing the best baseball definitely in the division and maybe in the league. Shh, don't tell the Red Sox.
Don't tell the Red Sox. You know what, Mike Lee, you've got the last shot. Make it a good one.
All right, cool. Michael Jordan is the GOAT, right?
No.
He's got the rings and things, the MVPs and scoring titles. His shadow looms over the sport the way Babe Ruth does over baseball and oatmeal raisin does over all of her cookies. This week, Rockets general manager Daryl Morey, one of the league's most respected team builders, reignited the conversation when he stated that based on advanced statistics, such as win shares and championships added, that LeBron is the greatest player of all time. By a bit of a big margin, he said. While adding, I know that's a little controversial, which is only a mild understatement. The argument is solely subjective, which makes it fun to some and annoying to others. Which leads to my next question. Why is basketball seemingly the only sport or profession or anything for that matter where the topic is even raised? We don't argue ice cream flavors. And why do we even engage in this discussion when our minds, including mine, are already made up?
There is no question, Michael Lee, that we can argue ice cream.
Okay, cool.
I'm a vanilla milkshake guy. I never win. But you know what? It's a great basketball question, and it's very specific to basketball. And I think it's because no other sport can one player have that much impact.
I would disagree that that's the only sport where we talk about this. Having just spent some time in the past week with both Willie Mays and with Joe Montana, don't get the Brady Montana argument started. And, you know, those of us who know for a fact that Willie Mays is the greatest will actually hear arguments from other people that are ridiculous. So I just think it happens more in basketball because, you know, there's only five guys on the floor at a time. But, you know, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, I think, because he's a really smart guy and went to UCLA.
Yeah, where
but
you
I
did.
But I think he should be in the conversation along with Magic Johnson.
Who is the best for me, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I personally am with Magic, but I think that a lot of times when it comes to this debate, it really is who led to you loving the game. And I think for me, Magic Johnson made me love basketball. So I think for like the younger generation, anyone under age, say 21, LeBron is probably going to be that guy.
Then for the really younger generation, like anyone under 12, that means Steph is going to be considered the greatest player of all time.
That's right, for their time. And for me, Magic Johnson made me love and hate basketball because as a Bostonian, you never wanted to see Magic Johnson with the ball in his hands coming down court at Boston Garden. But on the other hand, you at some point, by the time of the junior skyhook, you had to just say, yeah, he's pretty damn good. There's nothing anybody can do about it. Michael, can anybody step in and make you say, nah, I think differently about this?
No, because Michael's run was sort of untouched and he had such a dominant run over the league that it's really hard to say that anybody else can match that.
Yeah, and you also have to defeat aliens in Space Jam as well.
That is true. We can't leave that out.
That's right.
But if LeBron takes the Lakers to a title this year, then he becomes the
You know what? If LeBron takes that team to the finals, we will have to do this again.
Don't worry. We will continue to do this for as long as LeBron is playing.
Absolutely. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been San Francisco Chronicle's Ann Killian. Thank you, Ann.
Thank you for having me. It was great to be here.
And Yahoo Sports' Michael Lee. Thank you, Michael.
Hey, thank you. It's been great.
For some, a gym is just a place to go and work out. Allison McGee, a writer living in Minneapolis, isn't one of those people.
In the back of a kitchen drawer, all my outdated Uptown YWCA membership cards are rubber banded together. The oldest shows a woman with long dark hair, barely out of college. Hello, girl I used to be. The most recent shows a middle-aged woman with a messy blonde bob. The day the Uptown Y opened, decades ago now, was the day I became a member. It was the first and only gym I've ever joined. The Y holds the invisible ghosts of my past selves. There's the locker I stood before after showering when I was 9 months pregnant and turned to see a gaggle of high school girls staring at me, some unable to stop laughing at the sheer size of my belly, a kind of fascinated horror in their eyes. There's the Fit Kids gym, which I privately nicknamed the Sick Kids Gym, where I used to leave my three little kids so I could work out. There's the huge pool we used to haul them to on steamy Minneapolis summer days. There's the desk behind which a male staffer said when he overheard me, the focused and quiet Y member who goes there solo and only to work out, laugh unexpectedly, "Whoa, you really should smile more. It totally changes your look." To which I, long schooled in womanhood, internally responded, "Has anyone in your life ever told you to smile more?" But outwardly just smiled a weary, polite smile. There's the track around which, when it's too hot or cold or icy outside, I have run, jogged, walked, lunged, and intervaled approximately 3,000 times. There's the drinking fountain where I've patiently waited behind others and where others have patiently waited behind me. There's the weight room where, over 3 years, I once observed in wonder a young, round, soft woman gradually transform herself into one of the most muscular people I have ever seen. She still goes to the Y, and so do I. And there's the hallway where, after an absence of months, I once saw a beautiful woman I'd worked out next to for years walking unsteadily between her two sons. The unrecognition on her face, the protectiveness of her sons, hushed me. Early onset dementia. I watched her walk around the track, each son holding an arm. Her body remembered its routines, the comfort and calm of ritualized movement. I can relate to that. Though I've moved many times, from various apartments to various houses, the Uptown Y, despite remodeling, policy changes, additions and subtractions of machines and classes, aerobics to Zumba to spin to body flow to vinyasa, has remained a constant in my life. When I joined the Y, I was childless and driven and getting up at 4:30 in the morning to write and write in hopes that someday, somehow, I would write the beautiful book I dreamed of writing. Now, at midlife, children grown, I'm still driven. That beautiful book I dream of writing still hovers before me, invisible in the invisible air. Once, a few years ago when I was leaving the track for the weight room, a man came up to me. "Are you Allison, the writer?" he said. "My wife and I love your novels." I looked at him in surprise, this man I didn't recognize, and thanked him. Has he too been coming to the Y for all these years? Over a lifetime, we returned to certain places again and again and again, physical manifestations of how and where we have chosen to spend our lives. Sometimes I stop and close my eyes and breathe and thank my muscles and bones and blood and brain and heart for all the work they do on my behalf, day in and day out, year in and year out, to keep me alive. How they will keep doing so until the moment I die. How magical our bodies are and the memories they hold. In those moments, the Uptown Y, mundane cinder block building that it is, feels sacred to me, a temple of time and work and love and memory.
Allison McGee is a New York Times bestselling writer whose most recent novels are Never Coming Back and What I Leave Behind. Linda Dahl says she wasn't always respected as a female fight doctor. Then she saved a boxer's eyesight.
After that, it was very different. I mean, the other doctors were asking me to teach them.
That's just ahead on Only a Game. And remember to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
So you just woke up, and you want to find out about the latest news. That is when you turn to Up First, the 10-minute news podcast from NPR News. Hear Up First on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Howard Bryant. Coming up next week on Only a Game, the story of a California man who taught judo in a World War II internment camp. But now the week's news with Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Howard.
Okay, June 13th, University of Maryland offensive lineman Jordan McNair died. He'd suffered heat stroke during a team workout the previous month. The university accepted responsibility, and they fired athletic director Rick Court. But McNair's parents want coach DJ Durkin fired, and I tend to agree with this, especially looking at the history of Maryland. This isn't the first time this has happened. What do you think?
I think he should lose his job, and I think he should be in criminal court. The point that Marty McNair, Jordan McNair's father, makes, which is a good one, is that every time a coach goes into a house and recruits a kid,
mm-hmm.
the first thing he says to the parents is, I will take care of him. You are handing your child to me, and I will take care of him. Pretty plainly, DJ Durkin didn't give a damn about the people's children that were
in his
charge.
Well, also, because this is not the pros. That cell job, you're really talking coach to parent, not coach to player as if you're in the NBA or
right,
the NFL.
Right, player, coach to agent, and you are talking about, in many cases, children. You're talking about kids who are under 18.
Now, what does this say to you about the culture of the coach? One of the things that we've been talking about for the last couple of years is the power of the coach, especially the college coach. You've got a huge responsibility here.
Oh, no question, and a college football coach has a particular one because of the nature of the sport. It's one thing to do things like this if you're training guys in the Marines to go land on a beach and take an airstrip. It's another thing if you're just trying to beat Michigan State.
Yeah.
This is embarrassing.
Yeah, Durkin is on administrative leave. What do you think is going to happen here?
I think he loses his job. Yeah, I think the pressure will get too great. The McNairs don't seem to be in any hurry to stop appearing and doing interviews at this point. So, yeah, I think the pressure is going to be intolerable on the university. And as you said, the University of Maryland has a history of this kind of thing.
Yeah, and across the line, whether we're talking about Michigan State, whether we're talking here, Tennessee, it's about time these coaches get held accountable a little bit more. All right, the Washington Nationals won 95 games in 2016. They won 97 in 2017. And then they fired Dusty Baker. Last year, we saw John Farrell get fired after making the playoffs with the Red Sox. The Yankees fired Joe Girardi after they went within a few innings of going to the World Series. And in Toronto, as we saw too, the Raptors fired Dwayne Casey after they had won more games than they'd ever had in a season. So this is kind of a disturbing labor trend for me. I look at this and I'm thinking, why are coaches suddenly so vulnerable? And by the way, the reason why I bring this up is because the Washington Nationals now are 500. They're 7 games out. And they're nowhere near as good as they were last year. What does it say?
And their clubhouse is a mess.
And their clubhouse is terrible, which is why they brought Dusty in the first place.
Right. I don't understand. I mean, I hasten to point out that most of the coaches that fall into this category are African American.
Also?
I don't know whether that means anything or not, but it's an interesting phenomenon. You know, I think just basically, you know, we've got across the board in all sports, we've got a pretty bad crop of owners right now. And, you know, we have problems with their attempts to control their players. We have problems with their ability to manage their own businesses. And I think, you know, the instant gratification problem is really starting to catch up with coaches and managers. The Washington Capitals became untenable for Barry Trotz. So he moved to
and they won the Stanley Cup.
And they just won the Stanley Cup. He moved to the Islanders, who will not win a Stanley Cup, you know, maybe in our lifetimes. So, you know, I really do think that across the board, we have a crop of owners now who aren't particularly dedicated to their sport. They're dedicated to monetizing everything about their sport, and they're dedicated to running them like they run their regular businesses.
Yeah, but it also says something specifically about that coaching managerial job, where there was a time where the coach was the face of the front office. Now the face of the front office is the GMs, it's the analytics departments, it's everything. And so what has that done from a labor standpoint to that actual job? Suddenly, you're not the boss anymore. You're like a middle manager.
Yeah, not only that, but you are made expendable.
That's
you
right.
are less valuable to the franchise than the general manager or the analytics guy.
Speaking of baseball, a baseball signed by all of the 1939 Baseball Hall of Famers
sold last weekend for a pretty amazing price. How much did it go for, Charlie?
Almost $700,000, $623,369, which is an all-timer. Apparently, it was originally collected by a White Sox third baseman named Marv Owen. He put the ball in a fur-lined glove and then put that in a safe deposit box, which kept everything pristine. He died in 1991. This is apparently the greatest piece of memorabilia.
So they just found this 27 years later.
Right. And apparently it's the greatest piece of baseball memorabilia of all time. But the previous record was a Babe Ruth ball that sold for almost $400,000. And the most paid for any baseball was a $3 million that Todd McFarlane spent for Mark McGuire's 70th home run ball in January 1999.
It's a little overpriced right now.
I was going to say, I don't think that one quite appreciated in value.
Finally, the what could possibly go wrong department. The Cleveland Browns. Wait a minute, that's it right there.
Hold on for a second while we gather ourselves. Go ahead.
So the Browns have come up with a new promotion that helps their fans celebrate the attainment of a pretty lofty dream. What is that promotion? And I'm trying to keep a straight face, but once again, when it comes to the Browns, I can't.
When or if the Browns finally win a regular season National Football League game, people are going to get free beer. The electromagnet that's locking the freezers will be turned off through a Wi-Fi connection, opening all the freezers for fans to enjoy free of charge, which they will probably have about 11 seconds to do before they get ushered out of the stadium. but I don't know, man. I don't want my beer served up on a Wi-Fi connection by an electromagnet. That's a little scary.
It's kind of like opens the possibility for chaos, people rushing for Bud Light, but then again,
they're football fans. They will already be drunk, and they'll just rush for anything that says beer.
Then again, maybe you should pay me to drink a Bud Light.
That's exactly right.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time, and he joins us each week on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Howard.
We've got some great stories in the works, and I really don't want you to miss them. So do me a favor and subscribe to the Only a Game podcast. It's basically the exact same thing as the radio show, but you can listen to it whenever you want. Our next story is about professional boxing, an ear, nose, and throat specialist, and a dominatrix. You can't make this stuff up. Here's Only a Game's Gary Wallach.
Linda Dahl moved to the Bronx in 1998 to begin a medical residency. There, she treated victims of gun and knife violence every day.
I would come home from the hospital, you know, after having experienced real violence, and I would be met with these images of more violence at home.
Dahl's husband was an avid boxing fan. She began watching televised matches with him. In June of 2000, they watched the welterweight title fight between defending champion Oscar De La Hoya and Shane Mosley on pay-per-view. Dahl was fascinated by Mosley.
And he was so quiet and reserved and almost gracious.
In a pre-fight interview, Mosley asked a rhetorical question. Why be afraid of what you want? That resonated with Dahl.
Very much so, because I don't think I really thought about the world in those terms. I wasn't thinking about what I wanted. I was just thinking about what I was obligated to do. That's from a first-generation immigrant mentality, but also as a physician. It was all about responsibility.
Dahl was an easy target in the highly competitive and mostly male world of surgical residency. Her upbringing in a Syrian family trying and often failing to assimilate in Minot, North Dakota, imbued her with a go-along-to-get-along approach to life. She was ill-prepared for the power struggles between residents.
Shane Mosley is out-hustling Oscar De La Hoya.
It was incredible. That fight was amazing.
Mosley upset De La Hoya for the title, and boxing captured Linda Dahl's imagination. She began thinking about what she really wanted. A happy marriage, respect, professional accomplishment, a better-paying job. By 2004, she was divorced and working in a well-established private practice on the Upper East Side. One day, she asked a patient about his line of work. She did that at the beginning of every exam.
And he mentioned that he used to work for HBO Sports, and for some reason, it just clicked in my head, and I immediately just blurted out, I want to be a fight doctor. To which he responded, "Why? Why do you want to do this?" And he said, "All right, I'm going to make some phone calls because they'd love the idea of a woman doing this."
They were the New York State Athletic Commission. Dahl immediately submitted her paperwork.
And then 9 months later, I got a phone call with an assignment.
Dahl would work her first match as a fight doctor at a charity event on October 14th, 2004.
I was ringside and it was incredible. I was terrified. The surprising part of it was that I felt so excited by the hitting and the sound of the hitting and the look in their eye and how they transformed into these different people when they're in the ring. I had never even seen a live fight. And I knew nothing about the rules. I didn't even know what fight doctors did.
She leaned over to one of the other fight doctors and asked for help.
I kept saying, "Is there a book? Is there a training manual?" And they said, "No, you just kind of show up and the guys will teach you. It's all on-the-job training."
Over the following months, Dahl got to know many of the boxers she protected in the ring.
I loved them. They reminded me a lot of the boys and young men that I met in the Bronx. They had a way to channel whatever difficult circumstances they grew up in the ring, and they all came from really awful circumstances. There was just so much compassion for each other. They were so open to connecting with, I think a lot of them saw me as a maternal figure.
But the fighters were sometimes squeamish about being examined by a female doctor, like the time when Dahl worked the Curtis Stevens-Marcos Primera fight in July 2006.
Curtis dealt Marcus a low blow.
Oh, boy. That's about as low as you're going to get. And I don't think that was by accident.
And it created this traumatic hernia, and Marcus was crawling across the ring, screaming in agony. And it really reminded me of cancer patients and the kind of screaming that I would hear in the hospital when people were going through treatment or dying. It was horrifying. The only way his hernia could be checked was if the doctor at his corner, who happened to be me, checked him at the ring. But because I'm a woman, he didn't want me to.
Marcus Primera was given a five-minute break by the referee. Primera got up from the canvas and continued the fight. He knocked Stevens out in the eighth round. Dahl had been ignored. She still hadn't earned full respect from the community of fight doctors. People in the boxing world made occasional unwanted passes. For decades, Dahl had been what she describes as a martyr. She often suffered in silence. And then she met a patient with a sinus infection who would help her change that. As always, Dahl asked what she did for a living.
And she didn't really want to tell me at first. And then, you know, she said, "Okay, I'm a dominatrix." And I couldn't believe my ears. And I just found it so fascinating. She was explaining how it wasn't about sex, it was about power. And it was, for her, it was about using her sexuality and sensuality to gain power and control over a man. I couldn't even wrap my head around it because I had spent my whole life trying to divorce myself from my gender and my sexuality because there was just no place for it. It always kept getting in the way.
Dahl did a makeover. She began showing up at fights with a new persona.
I changed my costume. I used to wear just kind of standard basic business suits, sort of higher neck shirts, flat shoes, ponytails. And I changed into these, you know, very tight black suits with patent leather stiletto boots and low-cut tops. And my hair was down, lots of makeup, and black latex gloves. It worked.
Dahl wore her new outfits to the office and to the ring. And people treated her differently. She began to get more and better fight assignments. She had frequent conversations in her mind with her alter ego, which she called the Dom. And then came the fight that she says changed everything for her. Miguel Cotto versus Pauly Malignaggi in 2006.
Oh, no, they may have to stop this.
Malignaggi sustained an injury that was right in my specialty. He sustained something called an orbital blowout fracture. This was a direct blow with the fist right into the eye socket. The weakest bone in that framework is the bone that holds up the eyeball. And immediately I knew what it was, and so I ran up to one of the other doctors and I said, he can't keep fighting. Like, he's going to go blind. He can't keep getting hit in the face.
But he did. For the final six rounds of the 12-round fight, Malignaggi was hit in the face a lot. Miguel Cotto won by unanimous decision.
And so we're in the dressing room, and, you know, Polly's really upset because he sees himself for the first time. And then another doctor comes in, and he says, I'm his personal doctor, and I'm taking care of him. And so I started, you know, explaining the injury, and he just was clueless. And then I did something that I'd never done before. I just said, well, what kind of doctor are you? And he said, I'm his hand doctor. And I said, just, all right, this has nothing to do with you. And then I just kind of took charge.
Dahl sent Malignaggi to the emergency room. She gave her diagnosis to the attending physician, and the boxer's eyesight was saved.
And it felt kind of amazing because it was just medical, which is really all I wanted to begin with. I mean, going through that whole role play as a dominatrix is really just to get me to a place where everyone would listen to me as a doctor. And then after that, it was very different. I mean, the other doctors were asking me to teach them.
Linda Dahl stopped working as a fight doctor about 10 years ago. She now has her own private practice in Midtown Manhattan. Along the way, she dropped her dominatrix persona, but she says she wouldn't be where she is now if it hadn't been for the Dom.
I don't think anything would have pushed me to fight for myself like that. And ever since those experiences, I just can't be a martyr. I think all of us are victimized at some point, but instead of using those experiences to define me, I just see them as opportunities to change and come up with other strategies to grow around them.
That's Dr. Linda Dahl speaking with Only a Game's Gary Wallach. Dahl's new book is Tooth and Nail, The Making of a Female Fight Doctor.
Each year, more evidence comes out about the long-term damage that football does to players' brains. Yet, the number of colleges offering football teams isn't shrinking. It's growing.
Young boys are being destroyed. They're being damaged because of football.
If you bang your head repeatedly against others, you won't get a good outcome.
It was a punch to the side of the head, a strong punch to the side of the head, that caused Charlie Moore to hemorrhage and eventually die.
Schools will start to drop football. It's just hard to know just what will tip it.
I know I can lose it and just lose all control. That's why I will never, ever own a gun.
Is it ethical for universities to sponsor football teams? Will football go the same way as college boxing? And what's happening to former college stars who are now struggling to survive? That's coming up next week on Only a Game.
I'm telling you things my family don't even know. You got me feeling too comfortable here.
Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Matthew Stock. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our senior producer is Karen Given. Our final word comes from former fight doctor Linda Dahl, who responds to a question about her evening with Mike Tyson.
Oh, Mike. He's everyone's favorite topic.
I'm Howard Bryant. Only a Game returns next week. Thank you for listening.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, and your NPR station. From the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, bridging the cultures of science and the arts by supporting new books such as Energy, A Human History by Richard Rhodes, chronicling 500 years of energy transitions. And the Wallace Foundation, fostering improvements in learning and enrichment for disadvantaged children and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas at wallacefoundation.org.